Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the last day of campaigning before Tuesday's Iowa caucuses and speak with Max Shelley, a professor of political science and statistics at Iowa State University. We will discuss the apparent tie between frontrunners Ron Paul, Rick Santorum, and Mitt Romney, and get a local perspective on the media bombardment of Iowans and a broader national perspective on a growing sense of alienation and disgust with our broken democracy at the same time that unprecedented media attention is focused on the rituals of our democratic electoral process. Then, with President Obama's recent signing of a controversial bill imposing sanctions against Iran's central bank, and Iran's retaliation with missile tests and naval exercises in the Gulf, along with the recent threat by Iran's vice president to shut the Straits of Hormuz, we will look into whether the U.S. and Iran are on a collision course. A specialist on Iran, Mazia Behrouz, joins us to assess how much both sides are on a trajectory towards war, having trapped themselves into an escalation of rhetoric and actions, where any spark could set off a conflagration in a volatile region that supplies 20% of the world's oil. Then finally, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, Steve Clemens, joins us to discuss the growing importance of the vice president's role in foreign affairs, with Joe Biden about to take charge of U.S.-China relations that the White House recently announced as its new priority in the coming years. We will discuss how someone who has been gaining more power and influence quietly, working behind the scenes in a number of critical foreign policy areas, could be the subject of rumors that suggest he will be jettisoned from the 2012 ticket for Hillary Clinton to run as vice president. Joining us now is Max Shelley, a professor of political science and statistics at Iowa State University. His research and teaching focuses on American politics and public policy. He is co-author of a major textbook, American Government and Politics, which is being used widely in introductory classes on American government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Shelley.
Wonderful to join you.
And you are literally at ground zero now for I think it's an unprecedented media blitz, isn't it? You cannot turn on the television without somebody trashing somebody else, right?
That's right. Yeah, the fur is flying very definitely among the candidates, and we're under pretty heavy bombardment. It's going to continue probably right up until the very start of caucuses, about 7 p.m. Iowa time tomorrow night.
So there is no rule against campaigning on Election Day?
No, there isn't. And actually, depending upon where candidates are able to show up themselves, they could actually do a little bit of last-minute stumping even at the caucus sites.
So what do you make of this apparent draw, if you will? They're all three leading candidates seem to be polling equally. Is that, you think it's likely to be the outcome? Everybody getting about 22%?
Probably going to be typified as a Pyrrhic victory for whoever knows out the other two major contenders. It's absolutely guaranteed no one's going to come away with anything close to a clear majority. Probably the best anyone will do is in the low to mid 30% range. So usually the top three, maybe the top four finishers are able to claim some degree of victory, punch their ticket out of Iowa, so to speak, and live to fight another day in New Hampshire or a little bit farther down the road, South Carolina or Florida. But basically half probably of the seven folks who are officially contending are going to be out of the running by the time the votes are tabulated or shortly after the Spinmeisters have their say.
But this has culminated an enormous amount of spending, right? And the one person who avoided Iowa or dismissed it and now has shown up with a vengeance, Mitt Romney, and he's supposedly picking up numbers, but so also is Santorum. So just to deal with Santorum, does that mean that the critical evangelical vote is coalescing around one person as opposed to splitting it between Santorum, Bachman, and Perry?
Well, I think the evangelical vote is starting to coalesce for sure. Yeah, that certainly helps explain Santorum's rise. Another element is that Santorum is about the last major candidate to be able to rise. You know, all the others have pretty well had their day in the sun. They crashed and burned, and Santorum is more or less the last one left to be elevated at this last stage. And he may like out in the sense that not having peaked earlier, he may not have enough time to be sufficiently trashed by the other candidates. He's probably going to benefit from that late coming to the front ranks.
But I understand that in 2008, when Huckabee won, the evangelical vote was about 60% of the Republican caucus votes. What would you put it at today?
Well, 60% is about right. That's based on an entrance poll for the January 3, 2008 caucuses. We don't have precise numbers, obviously, yet, but the pre-election polls, especially done by the Des Moines Register, the major statewide paper, is suggesting that the evangelical portion is probably down to maybe only a third of all YP participants. Well, we'll have to wait and see, obviously. In a little bit over 24 hours, we'll have a pretty good gauge of that. But it apparently one of the things that's been going on that's helped to drive this perpetual rise and fall of the more socially conservative candidates, particularly, is that a lot of the folks who would have turned out as evangelical representatives 4 years ago just haven't been in the game until very recently. It's also worth noting that even the most recent statewide poll is still showing about 40% of respondents indicating that they might change their minds. So there's still plenty of volatility here.
And what explains that sort of explains Santorum's rise, or the fact that he's a factor now. What explains Ron Paul's? Now, he has a lot of support from libertarians and to some extent from anti-war Democrats. They can't vote, though, can they?
Well, actually, they can. It's important to realize that you do have to profess by signing up to become one, profess being a Republican at the time of the caucus. It's a trivial process. You sign a sheet of paper, you become a Republican, perhaps just overnight, and the next day you can go back and change your registration back to what it was before. So it's not quite an open primary, but it has some interesting implications that are kind of similar to crossover voting. It's worth keeping in mind, too, sort of an obvious fact, that there is no real contest on the Democratic side. Probably that'll mean substantially lower turnout among the Democrats, too. And Democrats who want to be in the game themselves tomorrow night might just stop by in Republican caucuses and maybe have some fun. There is also probably going to be a much heavier participation by political independents in this process. Political independents, by definition, don't belong to either of the two major parties, so they're open to try out pretty much any new game in town. And I think there might be sufficient interest on their part that many of them will show up. Now, that latter fact in particular, and the anti-war Democrats who might show up at the Republican caucuses, might help Ron Paul possibly finish a close second. I guess he could barely eke out a majority, well, it'd be a plurality, over any other candidate, assuming that crossover turnout's fairly high.
So it's not an open primary, but it's just that easy to infiltrate, and there. And so, given how easy it is, has there been evidence in the past of Democrats and other people with other political affiliations crashing the Republican caucuses?
That's happened somewhat. One of the twists, of course, this year is the Occupy movement. They've been very active, and well, several dozen have been arrested demonstrating, by the way, both at the Obama headquarters and various Republican headquarters. They're definitely not playing favorites. They're protesting pretty much everybody in the establishment. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually on a listserv where I'm tracking this kind of thing.
Now, that's at the Renaissance Hotel, right? They occupied the 12 were arrested today, with 50 lying on the floor of the Renaissance Hotel in the lobby in Des Moines, decrying the influence of corporate money in politics and Obama's signing of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah, they seem to have plenty to decry from all sides politically. So there is a boomlet, at least. It's not going to be a large number of people, but there's some effort among the Occupy wing of the political spectrum to show up at, I guess it could be either the Democratic or Republican caucus, more likely the Republican, though, and vote for uncommitted. There was an earlier discussion, by the way, about whether the Republicans would even count uncommitted votes, and I think they decided that they are going to do so.
So that's the sort of none-of-the-above type of protest vote?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. It's not likely to wind up being a significant percentage, but it's a way to vent frustration. And mm-hmm. when you feel like pretty much the whole political establishment is on the wrong side of where you are, it's one of the few things you can do that's at least a peaceful way to express satisfaction.
Well, in that vein, Max Shelley, again, professor of political science and statistics at Iowa State University and author of the major textbook American Government and Politics, I find it somewhat paradoxical that this is a year where I think there's unprecedented alienation from the political system and frankly, disgust with the gridlock and the games in Washington, D.C., and more people are registering as independents. The Democratic and Republican registration is way down. And yet at the same time, the media seems to be sort of celebrating and almost obsessing over political process, not results or content, but process. So does that paradox occur to you?
Oh, yeah, it certainly is a paradox. It's something that's been kind of perpetual in American political history. So it's not exactly a new thing on the agenda. To pick up on one point you just made regarding the rise of the political independence, I just Googled this up so to be sure about the data. Nationally, among all adults, something like 41% identify themselves as in surveys as independents. Republicans are down to 25%, by the way, and Democrats about 30%. So if there ever were an opening for a third major political party, this sure seems like a propitious time. Now, whether that's going to grow out of the current angst and alienation so many people feel, hard to say, because that sense of disconnectedness from the political structure isn't really a matter of ideology so much. It's not that the conservatives are bent out of shape or the liberals are feeling alienated. It's pretty much all of the above, feeling that they don't really have much of a role. And to go back to your earlier point about the current media blitz, some of this is, definitely not helped at all by things like the recent Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United, which basically made it very easy for these super PACs to form, to throw millions of dollars darn near at the drop of a hat, it's almost instantaneous now, to wage advertising campaigns against whomever the target of the day is. That's one of the things that's very, very new and different right now. And I guess depending a lot on your perspective, you could regard that as something of a real serious threat to the survival of the Democratic polity if people with deep pockets can have that much influence that quickly. That's almost certainly one of the reasons why you've had this extreme volatility, really fast surge and often equally fast decline or almost destruction of some of the candidates on the Republican side. Mm.
Well, it's just that as the more people are alienated from our democracy, the more the media appears to be celebrating it. And that's the paradox that I found puzzling.
Yeah. Well, indeed, yeah. The media like a good fight, and they like a show. The horse race aspects of this are really fascinating. I'm sure we've all seen the up-and-down graphs of support for the different candidates. And that's the kind of thing that's, I suppose, it's literally fun to report on. It doesn't get to the heart of the matter, however, about the angst and other difficulties. Mm-hmm. If you want other numbers to throw into this picture, the latest Gallup poll showed that Congress has an 11%, just barely in double digits, favorability rating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd heard that it was 9. So
lower than that, even if you try very hard.
Well, you have to ask yourself, who are those 11%?
Yeah, you think maybe just not paying attention or something.
Right.
By the way, that popularity for Congress is down to just 7% among independents.
Right.
It's about 12 or 14% for Democrats and Republicans, respectively. So basically, nobody likes Congress. The presidency is in a little bit better shape, but even there, Obama is just sort of barely sort of has even percentages for and against. So he personally and the presidency in general aren't doing terribly much better.
But nevertheless, we will spend most of this year going through these rituals, surely, as we move to New Hampshire, then South Carolina and Florida, etc. And meanwhile, billions will be spent. There is a sort of disconnect here, it seems, between...
Well, there is, and then a lot of people are going to make money off of this, for sure. The Obama campaign reputedly is going to try to raise, and I presume spend, about $1 billion. That's pretty staggering.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're watching the dress rehearsal now.
Romney's
super PAC has pounded Gingrich into submission, right? Now he says he's going to take off his gloves and fight back, but I guess he too little too late.
It's a bit late, yeah.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just any last thoughts, because we're just going to move on. But you just told us that this could go on till the campaigning could go on till 7 p.m. tomorrow, and I take it there'll be quick results after that, though, won't there?
Yeah, pretty fast. I would say by 9 p.m. Central Time, you should have at least early returns. Our local news broadcast at 10 p.m. local time is certainly going to have pretty much complete results.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Max Shelley.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been talking with Max Shelley, professor of political science and statistics at Iowa State University. He's the author of a major textbook, American Government and Politics, which has been used widely in introductory classes on American government. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the U.S. and Iran on a collision course towards war. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mazia Behrouz, who's a native of Iran, is currently a professor of history at San Francisco State University, previously taught at UC Berkeley and Stanford University, and he authored a number of articles and books on Iran, and is the author of two books on the history of leftist movements in Iran, Rebels with a Cause and Perspectives on the History of Rebels with a Cause in Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mazia Behrouz.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly there's been an escalation of rhetoric and actions. And on Saturday, President Obama signed the controversial National Defense Authorization Act that includes the imposition of sanctions against Iran's central bank. Iran has retaliated with missile tests, an anti-ship missile test, which with the Qadar missile and several other missiles were tested, along with fairly extensive exercises in the Gulf, in and around the Straits of Hormuz, exercises designed to practice the shutdown of the Straits of Hormuz, which Iran's vice president last Tuesday suggested is something in the cards. So how do you respond to all this? Is this really escalation towards war or some other kind of theater?
I look at it as more rhetoric and saber rattling rather than any immediate cause for war. Listen, the person who made the threat, the vice president, has no military authority. And Iran is about to go through a parliamentary election where the president and his colleagues in the cabinet are one faction versus the supreme leader and people around him. So, in the absence of political parties or
fully shaped political parties in Iran. Iran's politics is really manifested in factional fighting. And these two factions, who in 2009 eliminated the reform faction, are now lining up against each other. And I think, you know, comments like that, what you just mentioned regarding the exercise, the military naval exercise in the Strait of Hormuz and the Indian Ocean, has more to do with that rather than that particular person, Mr. Rahimi, having any authority to order Iran's military to do this or that. The second issue I would like to discuss with you is the President Obama is consistent with what he said he would do when he was elected into office. That is to say, attempt to not use military force regarding Iran, but to use other levers to persuade Iran to abandon what America thinks is its nuclear weapon program. And the central bank issue that you just mentioned and he signed is consistent with that policy. Iran's exercises have been going on for many years, both in the air and on the ground and in the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean, and it's nothing new. And these exercises were probably designed and prepared for months in advance, if not years in advance. So I do not see any direct correlation between the events that we just you just mentioned.
So the law cutting off U.S. financial systems, cutting off foreign firms from any U.S. financial interaction with U.S. on financial systems, if they do business with Iran's central bank, apparently, the U.S. and the Saudis try to persuade India not to buy Iranian oil. I believe they have been rebuffed. But it's likely other countries will not buy Iranian oil because they don't want to be sanctioned from doing business with the United States. At some point, before this bill was signed by the president, of course, there are other aspects of the bill that civil libertarians and others are concerned about. There was talk in Iran that this could be considered causa belli, that that if you cut off our ability to function as an economy, we're going to go to war. Again, is that rhetoric?
Well, first of all, I think the president has a lot of discretion on where to apply this law and where not to.
Yeah, he's got a 6-month waiting period, yeah.
Right. So, which means he has to be very careful regarding the oil market and the damage that the absence of Iranian oil would do to the economies of the United States and its allies. So that's, I think, that's why he has the discretion. So he cannot just go and, for example, tell India to go ahead and ruin your economy, because if we take Iranian oil out of the market, there will be a shortage of 3 million barrels a day, unless they can cover it. And I think they are in this process to see if they can cover it or not. But I don't think that process is fully in place, and I do not think they have a replacement. Mm-hmm. So for better and for worse for American foreign policy, Iranian oil needs to be in the market. And if it is in the market, it needs to be paid for. So in that context, I think it's, again, more rhetoric than actual action.
Well, but I don't think there's any doubt, is there, Professor Behrouz, that Israel has been making noises, the Netanyahu government in particular, that they consider the Iranian nuclear program a existential threat. And there have been lots of rumors throughout the last summer of senior Israeli intelligence officials warning that Netanyahu was isolated and paranoid and bent upon attacking Iran. And there's a suggestion that the White House had to step in and try and stop this because they understood how catastrophic it would be. They have removed American troops from Iraq, so there won't be the opportunity to retaliate from Iran if such a thing would happen. But the long and the short of it would seem that perhaps what's going on behind the scenes with Israel urging an attack, Saudi Arabia urging an attack on Iran, and the United States would therefore be forced into more stricter sanctions to placate this pressure?
Well, you know, the type of threats that you just mentioned are exactly, and you know, in the context of the invasion of Iraq and what happened in Libya, are exactly the reasons some people in Iran argue that Iran needs to have a nuclear weapon in order to protect itself against such belligerent and overt threat from the outside. But having said that, I really do not see, and I do not think Israel is capable of carrying out what it says it wants to carry out. I think Iran has enough adequate deterrent, military deterrent against the state of Israel to make the Israelis think twice before they attack. And I think in that sense it is a rhetoric. The Saudis basically said if the strait is closed, we will prevent it and we'll do something. But, you know, we have no way of assessing the Saudi armed forces. We know they have high-tech weaponry. But we also know that a small Iraqi force during the first Gulf War forced them to retreat. You know, besides the 1,000 troops that they sent into occupying Bahrain, we don't know how good the Saudi army or military is and whether it can carry out any type of operation. So that leaves, in my mind, that leaves us with only one country that is capable of carrying out such massive attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran that it would completely cripple its military, therefore providing the opening for crippling or destroying its nuclear industry. And that country is the United States. And I just do not see and cannot see how the United States can do this in the context of world affairs today.
Well, then what about regime change? We talk about diplomacy and how diplomacy should be used. And Obama did start out with an olive branch to Iran, and it's gotten nowhere. I don't believe that you can get very far with the Revolutionary Guard Corps and this Khatami government because they're so invested in anti-Americanism. I don't see that as a particularly useful way. So what about the seething green movement? Is there any possibility there?
Well, my opinion is that the green movement, my opinion is that the regime has consolidated itself, and the green movement is not the vibrant and viable alternative that it was 2 years ago. That it may show up again at some other point in some other format, it may. But for the foreseeable future, I do not see the Green Movement as an immediate threat to the regime. Which means that regime change in Iran, if we exclude an outside invasion and all-out war like the one that happened in Iraq. A situation like Libya or even Syria as we see it today, and I think Iran's case would be much closer to Syria rather than Libya, but even a case like Syria I think is unlikely in the immediate future, and by that I mean the next few years. I think the regime, the Islamic Republic leadership right now, under the leadership of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, has more or less consolidated power and has created a hierarchy strong enough to make it able to face off foreign challenges. And I think that's why they're being so type of challenging to the United States and the rest of the world regarding the nuclear weapon program and the sanctions, because I think they have put their internal home in order. Now, I know observers disagree with me, and they think that the Green Movement is kind of fire under the ashes and things like that, but I just do not see it. And I may be wrong, I'm not saying I'm 100% right, but I just do not see the organization, the leadership, and the structure that can pose a existential threat to the Islamic Republic in the near future.
So, but this regime would welcome war, not its destruction, but any threats bolster its legitimacy. Yet at the same time, it doesn't appear to be in any interest in any serious diplomacy. So, what's the outcome going to be here?
I think I think we have adequate examples of regimes other than Islamic Republic using international isolation to consolidate internal power, to say that the Islamic Republic is probably trying to do the same thing. Look at Myanmar or Burma, look at North Korea. Isolation actually helps these regimes to consolidate their internal, to clean up internally and consolidate their power. And I think the Islamic Republic of Iran has been using a foreign enemy ever since its conception in 1979, starting with the American hostage crisis, to do just that. And I am sure, and I have no doubt, there are real forces within the Iranian ruling elite that are adamantly for this policy and against normalization of relations, particularly with the United States. Unfortunately, I think there are similar forces in the United States which are against the rapprochement with the Islamic Republic of Iran.
So they have a mutual nemesis then.
I think there are factions within both governments. In the United States, right? The neoconservative movement, the APACs, pro-Israeli lobby, right-wing politicians. They are consistently and systematically sabotaging any effort of rapprochement or even normal negotiations or having an embassy with the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think the same type of people exists in Iran.
Right.
There is a faction in Iran that uses every opportunity that it can get its hands on to sabotage any type of rapprochement.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mazia Behrouz.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Mazia Behrouz. He's a native of Iran, currently professor of history at San Francisco State University, previously taught at UC Berkeley and Stanford University. He's the author of numerous articles and books on Iran, and is the author of two books on the history of leftist movements in Iran, Rebels with a Cause and Perspectives on the History of Rebels with a Cause in Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the power of the Vice President, Joe Biden, that's on the rise.
Taste the fear. Lift me up, take me out of here. Don't want to fight, don't want to die. Just want to hear you cry. Who's going to throw the very first stone?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Steve Clements, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He is also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously served as executive director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California, and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still director. Welcome to Background Briefing, and Happy New Year, Steve.
Happy
Clements.
New Year, Ian. Great to be with you.
And you've been have a piece now out at The Atlantic, Biden Gets China, on Vice President being handed this very important portfolio, given that the Obama administration sort of have tilted towards the Pacific and away from Europe. Tell me, though, what's going on with Biden's general fate here? Because these persistent rumors are about that he will be dropped as VP and Hillary be put on the ticket to bolster Obama's reelection chances.
Well, I have no information about that. I still would be in the school of thinking that thinks it's highly unlikely. I think that from my time in the White House, I don't sense any reality to that kind of tectonic shift, but you know you're talking about a very very high level decision, and my sense it would be historic and perhaps look desperate for that kind of shift. That said, As I wrote in the piece, Joe Biden has been tasked with several foreign policy things that at the time he was given them were not, you know, high profile and not, you know, page turners in the New York Times and Post and LA Times. They were kind of behind the scenes deals. One was in the nuclear materials summit that Biden really did the background work and on getting a Russia reset and doing a lot of the real day-by-day negotiation between various parties inside Iraq. And all of these have gone from the perspective of today, they've all gone rather well. And so his deck on the foreign policy side is clear. And I asked him about a month ago what his next deal would be, and he said China. But I think that at that time, there was not yet the real shift in place that he would be seen and recognized as leading on the China portfolio, but it's since been confirmed to me. And it's interesting, and in part it makes a lot of sense because China's vice premier, who is likely to be the next premier of China, is one that is at a different level and footing than Tim Geithner and Hillary Clinton. So Biden getting this role is something that makes a lot of sense structurally.
So are you talking about a vice president to vice president relationship?
Yeah, a vice president to a vice president who is also a president in waiting. Xi Jinping is going to ascend, by all accounts, to be China's president in 2012. And because that is widely known and widely interpreted to be the case, you know, power is a function of future expectations. And so Xi Jinping is on the rise. And thus, just having our Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of State, both very distinguished cabinet members, very high ranking, managing the China and U.S. Strategic and economic dialogue still isn't of the stature they need to basically influence and to court a relationship with the Xi Jinping. So that's where this has been tilting and why they're positioning Biden now to get this China-U.S. portfolio, which has been somewhat without direction because you do have Treasury and State both sort of co-managing it, but it seems amorphous to many folks. And I think this is a way to both elevate the stature of the China portfolio and its significance and to put somebody on it who has line responsibility to the president.
And Xi Jinping, Steve Clements, is he the generational shift that a lot of analysts have been waiting for? Most of the Chinese leaders since the revolutionary cadre of Deng Xiaoping have been Soviet-trained engineers, somewhat gray, somewhat opaque technocrats. How would you describe Xi Jinping?
Xi Jinping is a princeling, but he is considered to be a brilliant guy who isn't in his position just because of his father's stature. He is someone who's been vice premier, been handling some of the toughest portfolios in China, and he's in that fifth generation group of leaders who is coming along in this next phase. And so he is a generational shift. He is the first person who hasn't been designated by one of the Long March leaders, both Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao, were set into place by Deng Xiaoping, who is really China's modernizer, if you will, and the person who set forth this amazing Chinese economic juggernaut, and you know, had that great line saying, you know, black cat, white cat, if they both, you know, catch mice, it doesn't matter. You know, which is basically him disavowing communism.
Right. And it's glorious to be rich,
degree,
right?
You know, set yeah. China forward. And I think Xi Jinping now is the third generation after Deng, and I think will make a very big imprint. But it also means that the leadership track that China has and the decisions it makes in this next year are going to be very complicated and potentially tough. And I think for U.S.-China relations, particularly with economic issues as convulsive as they are around the world, but also the fact that China's growth and China's stature have become such that almost any international issue, from climate change to dealing with war-torn and fragile states to big geostrategic issues elsewhere in Afghanistan, you know, you scratch beneath the surface, and China is involved in all of these. So the relationship matters a lot, and I think that Joe Biden becoming much more deeply involved in that portfolio makes a lot of sense.
So, Steve Clements, you mentioned Xi Jinping's father. Who was he?
I knew you were going to ask that. He was also a Xi, and his father was a, I believe, a former premier of China, but you'll have to go back and look. I don't have it in front of me at the moment.
But that's
but his dad was a very high-ranking leader in the Chinese government.
Thus giving this new vice premier, at some points, I guess, in the next year or so, will be president, right?
Yes.
Giving him the princeling title, since he's...
Well, there are a lot of princelings, and the princelings are considered to be, you know, sort of like what George W. Bush was to George H.W., that there are a princeling is someone senior ranking in the Communist Party who's descended from one of the other senior level Politburo or State Council members at the highest levels of government and the Communist Party, who have come up from the next generation, and they themselves are moving into positions of authority and prominence. And so many would say, well, that's kind of a corrupt thing. But my estimation and discussions with very candid discussions about Xi Jinping with people is he is both related to the right line of folks. But that he's also very accomplished and competent in contrast to some others in this way. So there are other princelings. It's just he happens to be the top one at the moment.
Right. And he's obviously followed the political track as opposed to becoming gloriously rich as Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah, he's definitely in the political track and has been vice premier along with Li Keqiang. Li Keqiang is, there are two vice premiers in China. Li Keqiang has been managing the China-U.S. Strategic and economic dialogue with another prominent state councillor in China named Bai Dong Guo, and the two of them have been managing the U.S.-China portfolio. But Xi Jinping has been involved on the edges of it. But he's, you know, right now, unless there's some catastrophe or major shift, which would be extraordinary. Most analysts think Xi Jinping will be the next premier, and the Chinese are treating him as such. And that's an indication that while you'll have other prominent people like Li Keqiang and others remain very significant, most people believe that Li Keqiang will succeed to Wen Jiabao's role, the premier role, as opposed to the presidency. And so we're beginning to see the outlines of who's moving into what positions fairly early, and it's kind of showing that the Chinese are getting better at identifying, you know, who will move into what roles, and there's a lot less intrigue than there used to be in past transitions of this sort.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and previously served as Executive Director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still director. You mentioned a little while ago, Steve Clemens, how China's role may not be as prominent, but behind the scenes, they're playing a very active role internationally. The Europeans have been trying to help them get their help to rescue the euro, which the Europeans seem, you know, almost incapable of dealing with, which I guess is a ticking bomb that we could talk about. But they played a constructive role, essentially rescuing the Kyoto, didn't they, down in South Africa recently? I mean, that was...
Well, I mean, it depends on what you call, salvaging. I mean, what they're doing is they're playing a role preventing complete
collapse.
Global wreckage in these issues, right. But I wouldn't say that they're leading the way out towards salvation and solving
these problems either.
No. It's sort of a middle ground. I mean, China, on one hand, is the necessary partner that one needs in many of these cases, but they're not necessarily ready to lead. And this is the dilemma for the U.S.-China relationship right now. You know, China is sitting on more than $3 trillion of currency reserves in the world. And you know, today in this world of, deficit nations and, economic austerity, those with money, make the rules. And they're changing global gravity. And you feel this with China. I lived in China last year for about 3 months, and you could feel how the world finance ministers and foreign ministers and heads of state were coming in and out of Beijing at a rate that was dizzying compared to the fact that I live a mile from the White House in Washington. We get a lot of visitors here, but nothing like is happening today in Beijing. And so there is this anticipation that China will be powerful, but it's not completely powerful today. And I tell everybody it's like an internet startup where you look down the road at what growth will give a company down the road, and it gets a premium on its stock value. Well, China's getting a premium on its power today, even though it's only about 100th in the world in per capita income. It still has serious internal problems, and it still considers itself a poor country despite generating vast wealth today. So China has a lot of contradictions baked into it that make it, you know, I wrote a piece once, I think you and I talked about it once, called Beijing's Fragile Swagger, that it has a lot of swagger today, but it also is very, very aware of its fragility. And it makes for somewhat of a schizophrenic relationship now and then.
But Steve Clements, surely there's something wrong with this picture, though, that a poor developing country like China, where most of its people live in poverty, and it does have a tremendous disparity in wealth, not unlike the United States, why should we be living off their savings? I mean, isn't there something wrong with that picture?
Well, I've always argued, I mean, there are two ways to look at it, and there are a lot of folks that are very critical and worried about China's strategic predatory trade, and I have been one of those who've raised a lot of these questions over the years as well about my concerns. But fundamentally, you can't blame China for educating its people, moving its affairs forward, nurturing its industries. You can blame the U.S. government a lot for letting strategic industries grow, not taking care of economic policy in the way it should have, and not figuring out a way to invest in a sustainable social contract with the American worker, so that they can continue to compete in a you know, fair playing field around the world. I feel as if, you know, you've had essentially subsidized U.S. multinational firms who've built themselves off of access to this great market we have in the United States, and then offloaded and offshored so much capacity to China that it has undermined a lot of our manufacturing base and job base in the country. Do you blame China for that, or do you blame the U.S.? And in my view, I've been angry at the negligence and dereliction of duty of U.S. government officials for a long time about this subject.
Well, I think a shining example, surely, Steve Clements, is that the U.S. was the leader in solar technology, and in the Bush-Cheney, the two oil men's interregnum, China has taken over.
Well, I would tell you, about 3.5 years ago, China produced about 5% of the world's solar panels. Today, China produces 50% of the world's solar panels, and if you include Taiwan, that is 70% of the world's solar panels. There has been a massive shift in solar production capacity worldwide to China. And of course, there's a WTO case building and a subsidy case, but that is after, you know, that is way after the fact. This was a case where President Obama came in ostensibly to build a new vital renewable energy sector that would generate how many jobs? I think it was about 5 million jobs he was talking about. I remember the New America Foundation did a study showing that there were about 75,000 certifiable green jobs in the United States at that time. So the level of you know, the green jobs deficit that the United States was running was enormous even 3 years ago. And that the absence of a kind of central plan, of a way to, you know, look at how you partner federal resources with state resources, with private industry, with universities, and connect that to, you know, state-based manufacturing incentives and research and development incentives. If you don't have that, then the nations that do have strategic plans essentially swoop in and grab what they can. And again, the negligence is not on China's part here. It's in our own legislators and governors and members of Congress and executive branch officials. So I do think that there have been, you know, there's been case after case after case in which we have allowed ourselves and to tie ourselves in knots and not move forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clements, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He has an article at Atlantic, Biden Gets China. Just back on Biden, he was originally supposed to be the domestic policy guru, wasn't he? I mean, what happened there? He's been all over foreign policy.
When Joe Biden came in, I think one reason that his team was putting out that signal is that they didn't want Hillary Clinton and Jim Jones and Bob Gates and others who were in, you know, very senior level national security positions to think that Joe Biden, who had been chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for so many years and was such an acknowledged national security and foreign policy expert, you know, messing up their turf. And so I remember getting a call from one of his chief aides and said, Steve, remember, he was just profiled in Working Mother magazine as one of the most family-friendly senators. We have a lot of other things we're going to do and maybe focus on the domestic and reserve space for something like a War Chairman Meriden Commission, something that the president cared a lot about but didn't have enough time for. Biden would take on these, you know, responsibilities on an ad hoc basis. But when you look at the line of things Biden has done, you have to basically, you know, step back and say, wow, he has handled a good number of these things without a lot of fanfare, and not always, you know, the sexiest topics, and dealt with them, I think, fairly well. And I outline these in the piece today on, you know, resetting Russia and on negotiating, you know, our basically withdrawal from Iraq, but also the Iraq political scene. And essentially, you know, moving us forward in the WMD and Nuclear Materials Summit as well, which was another very big deal to President Obama at the time, but it didn't get a lot of headlines. But each one of these were handled very, very competently. And then, of course, we had the big Afghanistan strategic review, which I didn't write about. It's one of the areas that I think Biden would have been excellent. But, of course, Biden didn't share the perspective of David Petraeus and the kind of prevailing view in the White House. We know that Biden was the cautionary force that basically said the surge is a bad idea, and that doubling down U.S. forces in Afghanistan and broadening this would be a mistake. And so Biden hasn't had that portfolio, but lo and behold, he's largely turned out to be right there as well. So for the guy who wasn't supposed to have a big foreign policy footprint, in many ways he's outperformed the other members of the team on Obama's side.
Well, it does appear that they are quite determined, if that's the right word, to get out of Afghanistan. And it's curious to look at the role that the U.S. has vis-a-vis China there. China supposedly has a good relationship with Pakistan, which is certainly not the case with the U.S. They recently apparently wrapped up a lot of oil and gas leases. There's a copper mine that they've built, which I think is being protected by U.S. forces. It requires, I think, a railway line that hasn't been built yet. What's your sense of filling the strategic vacuum when the U.S. gets out? Is China really that interested in Pakistan, which is, I think, pretty much a basket case?
China is very much a non-interventionist country that sits back and waits for opportunities when they present themselves. China is a major investor in a significant copper and minerals mine, the largest in Afghanistan. It's actually a very interesting case you should look at sometime, because it's also it's a mine that's been in active in various forms for thousands of years, and it's one of the great sites of mankind's archaeological history. And China is delaying the exploitation of that mine and facility, and working with us and the Europeans to try to move out as much of these archaeological treasures that really haven't been dealt with or excavated. Because Afghanistan has been such a mess for 30 years. They've been in civil war essentially for 30 years, and there hasn't been the same kind of investment in that arena. So, you know, China's doing something which is, you know, applaudable and I think very important and isn't often discussed. But you know, that said, you know, China benefits enormously by not being looked at as the bad guy that's intervening in other countries. And America's out there looked at as good guys by some and bad guys by others, certainly on the edge militarily and controversial. And, you know, there used to be this joke that America fought the Gulf War and Japan won, and now the Cold War and Japan won, and now it's America's fighting the war on terror and China's winning. So, you know, the notion that U.S. is projecting its power and capacity through what we have at the Pentagon, and China's using its economic capabilities to go out and invest in mines and, you know, build infrastructure and dams and telecommunications in Africa and Latin America and South Asia. And essentially, to some degree, whether they're corrupt arrangements or not, China is building out what will probably be the middle-class leaders of these countries, you know, 20, 30 years from now. And that's going to give it enormous political power and very deep economic stakes. That's a different model than we're following today in the United States, which is much more Pentagon forward, military forward position, and to some degree, if we run into trouble, you know, with a nation like Pakistan, sure, you know, China's now looked at and has the capacity and the wealth to be considered the alternative to the United States, and that's a real problem for us. They're becoming and I think it's very clear that while we have to cooperate with China in many ways, they're also a strategic competitor with us today.
Well, in closing, Steve Clements, in that regard, the U.S. President Obama recently went to Australia where they talked about stationing 2,500 U.S. Marines in Darwin, met with the Asian nations to the south of China who appear to be somewhat nervous of China's growth. The U.S. has also showed up, surprisingly, in Burma, Myanmar. I think the Indians have been urging them to do that for some time. How much of that is a zero-sum game vis-a-vis U.S. influence versus China's influence? And how much do the peripheral nations in the South, they appear to genuinely be concerned about China's growing power?
Well, I think the fact is that China's power is growing. And so people are worried about what will that mean about the political equilibrium in the region. And those forces are meant to counter a tilt towards China. This is not about forces colliding with one another. This is about shadow games where one nation can easily intimidate another because that nation feels weak. And so what you have is the U.S. strategically redeploying some forces. We've often talked about Okinawa, moving some forces out of Okinawa to other parts of the Asia-Pacific region, both to shore up relations geopolitically with various ASEAN countries and to show that the U.S. Believes that Asia is where the future is. And then it matters. And I think President Obama and his National Security Advisor Tom Donilon and others have made it clear that they don't want to be seen withdrawing from or distracted from Asia. And they do have the belief, and I think it's correct, that the Middle East, to some degree, has had an over-deployment of American resources in it, and it has really created an impression that America is chasing, you know, the wrong bunny. You know, it's growth and the economic vitality of Asia are very real and palpable and matter to American interests. And it doesn't mean you're going to secure that through security forces, but it is a symbolic gesture to show that they're there. And if you really talk to the Chinese are going to, you know, raise a ruckus about, you know, moves that they think are designed to contain them. And there is a paranoia. But on the other level, China realizes that the region is also made more stable for its own growth. China wants to have largely the status quo continue for a very long period of time. It has grown and benefited enormously from geostrategic stability. And I don't think that China has any intention of trying to rock that situation in Asia much, that it is so focused on trying to urbanize another 300 million people, which itself will create its own global disruptions of trying to take 300 million people out of poverty and bring them into a global middle class. That's going to create a lot of stress both at home and in China and around the world because, you know, those are 300 billion more consumers, but they're also 300 billion more workers.
And polluters.
And right now there's not a lot of jobs going around for those that are, right. that are you know, sort of connected. And I think that's what we're dealing with, is that there is no ability to hold everything together where it is today. Things are changing. China is becoming more powerful. But the U.S. can't disentangle itself from the Asia-Pacific without paying a very big price for it.
Well, Steve Clements, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clements, who's the Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a Senior Fellow and Founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation. Previously, he served as Executive Director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still Director. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.